Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Last month, Hurricane Florence walloped parts of North Carolina. According to the Weather Channel, it was the wettest tropical storm to ever hit the Tar Heel State. So how did the restaurant industry respond? Some helped FEMA weather the storm, while others got to work feeding people on the ground.
We just walked in and said, we know how to cook, what can we do? They said, I need you guys to just cook 150 pork loins, and we were just like, okay.
Now the attention needs to be on Florence's long-term effect on North Carolina's farming community.
The general mood of farmers is one of certainly resilience and almost feels like it's the normal course of business to just get hit by a gigantic hurricane and need to just keep on going.
So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host Akiko Tema, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deal in the supermarket, but what is beyond the sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And I have three guests today from Katana Kitten, a new Japanese-American bar in the West Village in New York City. Masahiro Urushido is the managing partner, head bartender, and the director of deliciousness. Masa became the Chef's Regal Global Master, one of the best bartenders of the world in 2014, and was the bar manager at Saxon Apparel, a great new American restaurant in the East Village. Masa came out to the show on episode 71 and talked about his cocktail philosophy and Japanese cocktail culture. And James Chun is the general manager and the managing partner. He's also the general manager and managing partner at the Boilermaker, the East Village mainstay. And he's been in the business a long time, as many as 15 years. And Greg Bohm is the co-owner and the founder of Cocktail Kingdom, and which brings rare to find great cocktail books and barware to the cocktail community. He's also the creative mind behind the Cocktail Kingdom Hospitality, which includes existing condition in Greenwich Village, Maze, and Boilermaker in East Village. Japanese cocktail culture is getting global attention lately, but we don't know too much about what it is outside of Japan. So today, we'll discover it through the unique concept of Katana Kitten. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher as a podcast, and also Spotify, actually. And so please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And if you have any ideas about topics or the show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org. And a quick announcement, the 23rd Sumo Stew is coming to New York on Monday, November 12th. At Brooklyn Brewery in Williamsburg. It will start at 8 p.m. And as you may know, Sumo Stew is a seasonal live streaming event of sumo matches straight from Japan, and you can enjoy Japanese food from outstanding restaurants as you watch the matches. Tickets are available at eventbrite.com, and look for Sumo Stew. It's S-U-M-O-S-T-E-W. It's a Sumo Stew. And for Japanese listeners, there is a $10 off discount code. That's SS Japanese. That's one word, WS Japanese. And finally, I'll be moderating an event at Japan Society on Wednesday, October 24th at 6:30 p.m. The theme is Crafting Beer, Traditional Techniques, Modern Brews. And Joshua Bernstein, beer journalist and author of Homebrew World, discover the secrets of the world's leading homebrewers. And he will trace how Japanese sake techniques and producers influence today's global craft beer trends. The talk and discussion will be followed by tasting of Japanese craft beers and the beers influenced by Japan. For tickets, please go to japansociety.org. That's japansociety.org. Now let's start a conversation with Masahiro Urushido, James Jun, and Greg Bohm. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So first of all, we'd like to know each of your backgrounds. So where are you from and how did you get into the cocktail industry?
I guess I'll start. So,
okay, so this is Greg.
Yeah. So I started, I'm from New York. I grew up here. I've lived in and around the city most of my life. I came into the cocktail world in a roundabout way. So I started in book publishing. And among other books, my family's publishing company published books about cocktails. And from that, I met a lot of bartenders, started importing barware, and then later opened my first bar with James, which was Golden Cadillac, followed by Boilermaker, a few others, and now most recently Katana Kitten.
So that's a very abbreviated version of introduction. I think you are really into details of cocktail history and bottles.
So yeah, through that, as I started learning about cocktails, I started collecting antique cocktail books. And I ended up with the largest collection of antique cocktail books in the world. I believe. I don't think anybody has a larger collection. Maybe somebody will correct me.
Oh, wow.
And I met a lot of bartenders who wanted to research using my books or sometimes purchase some of the cocktail books from me. So I met a lot of very influential cocktail bartenders. And that at that time, a few of them mentioned to me it was difficult to get good barware in the United States going back 14, 15 years ago. So I started importing barware from Japan and Germany, and that was the beginning of Cocktail Kingdom.
Wow. So, I heard that you even gave a lecture to Japanese bartenders in Japan. So.
Yeah, at the Peninsula Hotel in Tokyo, I've given lectures to Japanese bartenders about the history of cocktails.
Right. I should learn more about that. So, okay, so what about you, James?
I broke into the business about 15 years ago. I started managing nightclubs and bars. Did that for a few years, and in 2007, I joined Pegu Club as a manager, and that was my first real experience with cocktails in the cocktail world.
So Pegu Club, by the way, for listeners not familiar with, that's like one of the best bars, no question.
Yes, it's a very respectable bar. It was one of the first, not the first, but one of the first doing cocktails of that caliber, and a lot of great bartenders came from there. And during my time there, I learned a lot.
Right.
It was a great experience overall.
And also, it's founded by a female bartender, which is like a record-breaking kind of achievement.
Audrey Saunders, one of my mentors. She's fantastic and really gave a lot to this industry and the cocktail industry in general.
And you're from New York?
Yes, I'm also born and raised in New York.
Okay, before the show, we were discussing where the bar, that cocktail culture came from. It sounds like it came from New York. So it's,
definitely New York's rich in cocktail history. I mean, where Cocktail Kingdom's offices are is on the same block where the Hoffman House was, which was the golden age of the American cocktails, roughly 1860s to 1890s, and one of the most famous bars was the Hoffman House, which is in the Flatiron District, was in the Flatiron District. Now it's the 40-40 Club. It's very, New York is definitely steeped in cocktail history.
Right. Okay, and Masa, I gave you a quick introduction at the beginning, but...
Mas.
So, you're from where?
Yes, I'm originally from a small town called Minowa in Nagano Prefecture. And my first job in hospitality was a place called Tablo's in Daikanyama, Tokyo. At a time when I started as a food runner, I was one of the finest dining in Tokyo. And before that, I was just delivering pizza, so it was quite stretched. But yeah, from there, I just, you know, really enjoy every single time I'm working in the restaurant and bar. So, and I moved to New York for college. But at the same time, this is what I wanted to do, is working in the restaurant and the bar. So,
right. Yes. Okay, so for listeners, if you want to know more about Masa's interesting background, you can listen to episode 71. Okay, so so why did you decide to open a cocktail bar together?
I mean, that was actually James's idea to bring the team together. We already had opened Boilermaker, and then, I mean, you can speak to that, James, as to how you had the idea to bring the team together.
Always been a fan of Japanese culture in general. I know Greg has been there a bunch of times and very knowledgeable in cocktails, and Masa's personality really fit what we all wanted to do, and that's kind of how it came together, opening up a Japanese-American neighborhood bar that did great cocktails, served great food, but in a very laid-back environment, exciting, happy environment, and I knew that three of us could open a place like that.
Right. So what's the Masa's personality fitting the concept?
He's a fantastic bartender, and he's very entertaining, kooky at times, which I love. It's all part of the experience that we're trying to, you know, bring at Katana Kid. And
it's the smile.
Yeah, his smile too. Always happy. People love coming in to see him.
Mm, right. That's another reason I used to go to his bars too. So, what is the concept of Katana Kitten?
Is this for me?
Yeah, sure, yes. Masa, why don't you discuss it?
I think Katana Kitten, the concept is this is a Japanese-American bar, but really in a setting of very casual, you know, everyone's everyday bar, and then that's something we wanted to create. And then lots of inspirations from izakayas in Japanese, very casual drinking, eating, meeting place. And so that kind of sort of meets some places like neighborhood loving Boilermaker, which is James and Greg's place in the East Village. So, you know, doors always open, and, you know, anyone can come in for like one drink to just bring a bunch of people back. And so it is we take pride in like what we deliver, the drinks and the food, but like it's really a very casual, laid back, fun place.
Definitely in Tokyo. I know it's a lot of people, a lot of Americans, I should say, think of Ginza-style bartending, which is a more formal-style bartending, if they start learning about Japanese bar culture. Having been to Tokyo many times, I can't count how many cocktail bars I've been to in Tokyo, and talking with Masa and James, we started realizing we want to take inspiration from other neighborhoods, other styles, so a little bit of the fun of Shinjuku, some of the history of Asakusa, some aspects of Ginza, of course, as well.
So you were saying Ginza is like high end, and Asakusa and Shinjuku like more kind of casual, you know.
To a large degree, Asakusa can be very traditional. Ginza can be high end, and yeah, Shinjuku can be, well, anything. It can
crazy.
Be fun, a little crazy. And as Masa was saying, we wanted to take the neighborhood bar, but not just one neighborhood. Really, aspects of the fun part, definitely, as well as the, you know, high-end cocktails.
Right. So why did you name it Katana Kitten?
I made that name up one day, and it was never really meant to be the name of the bar. And we weren't coming to a consensus on another name. And we started asking different people, and not everybody loved it, but everybody had a reaction to it. And we definitely wanted a name that didn't sound like a restaurant. So yeah, eventually we all agreed to it. It wasn't instant. We had to live with it for a while.
So what's the meaning of Katana Kitten and the implication of it?
I mean, the literal meaning, katana being Japanese samurai sword, and a kitten is a young cat. But more of it, the katana has a sharp edge. There's some precision in what we do. And the kitten, I would say, represents the playful aspects of, at least that's my take on it. You know, the kitten is more the playful aspects. You guys may have a slightly different take on it.
Similar, the katana aspect is the serious side of, you know, our cocktail program is we take seriously the food aspect of it, the product itself. Mm. And like Greg said, kitten is more of the playful, fun side we bring to the table.
Mm. Okay. Right, so, like, you know, Masa mentioned, it's izakaya part that's casual and everyday. And, for listeners who are not familiar with exactly what the izakaya is in Japan, maybe you can just summarize what izakaya concept is in Japan.
Yes, izakaya, when you walk in and then when you experience, it's very easy to describe it, that the izakaya itself is very casual neighborhood eatery. So they serve alcohol and they serve food, and definitely reflect on where that owner or either the location is from. So if you go to like north and the west, and each neighborhood's got the reflection of the seasonality also on the menu. So, you know, from spring to the winter, and, you know, drink sake, beer, highballs, and these little skewers and all these things. And then that's where you can really eat relatively or very, very cheap. That's the very approachable, you know, like very inviting style of the food establishment and then drinking establishment. But, you know, cheap doesn't mean, like, or reasonable price doesn't mean, you know, that they're slacking the preparation or, you know, that the flavor is, like, better, like, you know, so, but, no, izakaya is great. It's pretty much everywhere, so you won't miss it. And, you know, when you land in Tokyo, and probably the first place you want to go fill your belly.
Yeah, because there's so many izakayas, and from small mom and pop to chain stores, they're so competitive that you find really good food there. So, yeah, it's a great place to be. Right, so that's the casual aspects in Katana Kitten's concept.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. Yep.
Okay. And, all right, so let's talk about the whole menu. So what's the signature cocktails at Katana Kitten?
Signature cocktails, we kind of section out three categories on the drinks menu. First one is a highball. Second one is signature cocktails, and then also followed by Boilermaker. So highball cocktails, so signature one, I would say this is a Toki highball. This is a grey whiskey from Suntory.
So highball,
yes,
is, by definition, in this country, like tall glass cocktail, right? But
yes,
in Japan, there's a specific identity associated with it.
I would say like 99%. When you say highball in Japan, it's referring to whiskey highball. And again, the Suntory is a big part of Japanese culture in general, and they make whiskey just specific for Japanese market as well. To make this one is called kakubin. It's something that the design and the juice hasn't changed for over 30-40 years. Highball is great, that the light and refreshing, essentially it's a alcohol and then carbonated and non-alcohol beverage. So that kind of basically lower the alcohol content when you consume, and also brings out lots of flavor, and amazing pair with all this food as well. When you go to izakaya, some are, you know, like all this pickle, like some are a little bit salty, some are a little bit oily, but, you know, pair with a highball, that's gonna basically cut through the fat, and then you can do it again for a long, long time over the night. But so yes, highball cocktail menu. But we included not only whiskey highball, but as a category, we have this house signature gin and tonics. Take on it all this dark and stormy. So it's something that falls into the category that we make season to season. Summer stays for over the seasons, but this kind of, you know, we put everything together to make a variety of offering in the highball as well.
And the Japanese flavors.
Yes.
Right.
I think each item has got like some certain Japanese either ingredients or all these traditions. And other signature cocktail, basically from martini to Negroni twist, all these classic cocktails twist, but take on our very special touches. And Boilermaker, again, that homage to Greg and James's bar in the East Village. So basically beer and shot, but we took that to more fun way, more playful way of essentially a pairing of the little something in a shot glass and to serve with either beer, cider, some unique item on the menu as well. It's called La Mea, but basically it's half bottle of Krug champagne and then comes with the four shots of tequila.
Yeah, that's fun. I was looking at it. And also, for instance, you have a Hinoki martini, that's Cypress martini, and you have Grey Goose and Spring 44 Mountain Gin, Pinot Sherry, and Junmai Daiginjo, and the Hinoki tree essence. So sounds pretty Japanese, and I...
Yes.
Right.
And it's still, again, that the very classic martini preparation, still nice and dry martini, but very, very unique. Again, the Hinoki tree essence, that's only you get to taste it at the in the Katanakin.
I'll be there soon and try this
one. Yeah, that one's pretty delicious. Hey. As are many of the drinks on the menu, but that one's really nice.
By the way, the Suntory just released a new gin, Roku, and vodka, like rice vodka.
Yes.
Zero. Have you ever tasted them?
Yes.
Hi.
Delicious.
So it's, I think, we're going to talk about Japanese bottles later, but Japanese spirits seem changing too. Like, it's expanding, not just the Japanese whiskey, but more products coming out to the market. So it's good for Katanakiten, I think.
Yeah, it's nice for us to have availability, not just things that are new to the market, which of course, you know, the Suntory gin, and but also things that we haven't been able to get before. Anytime that there's a new Japanese product available in the United States, it's certainly exciting for us.
Right. Okay. So what about the food? That's, you know, izakaya food, I think.
Certainly inspired by that.
Yes. Maybe James want to talk about the experience in Tokyo. That's it. We took a trip in Tokyo last year. Before
October before opening,
And then, you know, like again, from the experience, we certain get like lots of inspiration for the menu. And then James maybe want to talk.
Yeah, about. It's the menu's not that big. It's about 11-12 items, but it's meant a lot of it is meant to be shared. A lot of it is smaller portions. So, as you're drinking cocktails, you're ordering food. You don't really order all the food at once. You can order and drink throughout the night, and that's kind of
very the experience.
Very izakaya. Very, you know, a lot of the places I went to Tokyo with Masa was like that, and it was great. It was, you know, so we have a lot of great dishes on the menu that go with our cocktails, and they're fantastic.
That's interesting. I think the restaurants, as far as I know, in America, tend to you asked. Order everything at the beginning. Probably they have to manage all the seating and stuff. I understand it. But I think in Japanese izakaya, you're just like, can we start with this? Of course. And as you go, you tend to order more because you drink more too. So
that'll definitely work to a Katana Kitten.
Yes.
Absolutely. That's, you know, that's part of the culture. You may start, you know, you may start with ordering the crudité or the deviled eggs. You have a few cocktails, maybe a few Boilermakers, and then you order some more things on the menu, and it's sort of that vibe. Where you can order and order food as you go. You don't have to order everything else.
Right. And I was looking at, you know, you mentioned deviled eggs, but it's with white miso and salmon roll, and there's uni add-on if you want to have add-on. So that's pretty Japanese too, even deviled eggs. So that's great. And what about the sandwich? Usually you say sandos. That's pretty Japanese to me.
Yeah, so my when I was in Tokyo with Maso, we had the classic katsu sando, which was ham, and I thought it was one of the best things I've ever had. And when we were working on the menu at Katana, we wanted to kind of do our version of it, and Maso wanted to do mortadella, which is fantastic, and we do our version of it, and it's one of the most popular dishes at Katana Kitten right now.
So I'd assume it's like Japanese style sandwich?
Yes, absolutely. Mortadella is kind of sort of like a bologna, but a very good tasting bologna, not what usually what Americans are used to. It's a high quality meat, right. and we fry it and we put it in
the fluffy Japanese bread.
Fluffy Japanese bread, no milk crust. Bread. Milk bread. Yeah,
yeah. That's I think it's a you know. By the way, in Japanese or you know the society, they don't say sandwich, but they say the sandwich, but sando.
Sando, yes.
Classic. Yeah, you can find a good sando even at the convenience stores.
One of the best sandals I had was in a 7-Eleven in Tokyo. And he told me about it, and I was, you know, I was kind of laughing about it. But when we went in there and I grabbed the egg sandwich, which, by the way, we also have our version of an egg sando on the menu. But I had the 7-Eleven one in Tokyo, and it was one of the best egg sandwiches I've ever had.
Well, I think a convenience store in Japan is quite different. Like it's not a convenience. It's a craftsman store in a way. Every single item, even like a dollar or two, you get the best onigiri. You have the best sandwich.
Yeah, definitely. I find when I'm traveling in Tokyo, it's where I eat a lot of my lunches. The foods. I mean, obviously, our chef. It's part of Cocktail Kingdom Hospitality, Nick Sorrentino, and then our chef at Katana Kitten's, Sid. Have been really taking inspiration from Masa and things that he remembers and has taught all of us, and then James' experience, and really made it approachable. And again, we're focusing on our cocktails, but at this point the food is become almost an equal part.
Right, so I think you know the concept of izakaya, like we discussed already, it's you need the food. And Japanese classic cocktail bars, you don't eat. You just keep your back straight and appreciate every sip, which is another classic beauty. But izakaya is more fun.
Yes, this is, the Japanese-American bar. And then the bar, good bar, has a great food, like wings and, you know, like certain thing that people come back for. So our case is, again, that people like our drinks, but also our food as well.
Right. And I think there's important difference also that in Japan, restaurants don't have waiting bars. So if you want to have good cocktail, you have to go to serious cocktail bars, which could be expensive, or you just have to, you don't know. At first time I went to Japan and, you know, I don't know what to do with the cocktail bars. It's like so serious and it's kind of intimidating.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, definitely when we opened, we didn't want to be too serious. I don't think it's a good fit for the West Village where we're located, and it doesn't really, it's not James Moss or my personality to be that serious all the time. But yeah, again, I think some of our favorite bars in Tokyo are also some of the less serious ones. I know Rock Bar Mother, James and Masa went there, and not knowing I had been there also, it's like definitely not a serious place. Loud place. But we definitely took our inspiration from all different types of bars in Japan.
Right, so it sounds like you have the best part of serious cocktails, like, you know, serious bars here and in Japan, but then there's an ambience that you can have cocktails, not sake or anything, and in the same place as restaurant ambience. So that's the best kind of idea.
Yeah, and we have two floors also, so the upstairs and the downstairs have a slightly different vibe to them. And they change throughout the night as well. So, I mean, downstairs can be a little more restaurant-y at the beginning, but late in the evening it's much more inspired by Golden Guy area of Shinjuku, which is small, a little bit irreverent, and kind of funky.
So Golden Guy, it's just a famous, you said funky, but it's a very concentrated area of crazy small, high quality, or just funky eateries.
With a lot of personality, too. I mean, I think...
ton of personality.
Yeah, each bar seems to be based on, you know, small bars with 4 to 8 seats. That's based on something from the owner's past, whether they were in a rock band once 30 years ago or they want to collect toy trains, but that's the focus. So we have a little bit of that personality downstairs that's really I think late in the, I don't know if you guys have a favorite time down there. I like it late in the evening.
Late night, it's always fun. We get larger parties down there as well, so it's a different vibe from what's upstairs. And I think downstairs you really get, if you haven't been to Tokyo, you really get that true feeling of being there in a type of bar style that they have there.
Yeah, we were inspired by Golden Guy, but we don't have six seats. We actually have room for a larger group.
Right. Yeah, but who come to your bar, the Cat and the Kitten?
The clientele is very mixed. Obviously, being in the West Village on Hudson Street, it's a very busy, popular street. We do get neighborhood regulars, but we also get people coming from all different types of neighborhoods. We've been lucky and fortunate enough to kind of spread the word and become popular, and we got some great press over the last month or two. So the clientele is very different. Age gap is different as well, 25 to 45, 50, just different kind of ages coming in here. And again, because we have the two floors, we can give people kind of two different experiences. If they want more of that restaurant sit-down feel, we can put them downstairs and upstairs. If they want cocktails and drinks, more standing room upstairs.
Mm, right. We definitely have a lot of people that are coming to see Masa and James from knowing Masa from, you know, different places, Saxon and Pearl certainly, and other places, and James from Boilermaker. We have a lot of people are coming as a destination heading to the West Village, where often East Village drinkers go all the way to Hudson Street to have a cocktail now.
That's amazing. Wow. Okay. So now let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about uniqueness of Japanese bar tools. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats Podcast live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and I have three guests today from Katana Kitten, a new Japanese-American bar in the West Village, in New York City. Masahiro Urushido is the managing partner, head bartender, and the director of Deliciousness, and James Chun is the general manager and the managing partner. And Greg Bourne is the co-owner and the founder of Cocktail Kingdom, which brings rare-to-find great cocktail books and barware to the cocktail community. So I would like to know more about the Cocktail Kingdom, because I know that you have great bar tools from Japan in the catalog as well. So sure. What is the Cocktail Kingdom, and when and why did you start the company?
So I started Cocktail Kingdom 10 years ago now, almost 10 years ago, and we started with doing republishing very important antique cocktail books to make them accessible to bartenders. And after I started doing that, people, mostly bartenders, let me know there was a need for better barware than was currently widely available in the U.S. So I started importing barware from Japan and from Germany. Over the time, it changed, and Cocktail Kingdom now designs and manufactures almost everything. About 99% of the products that we sell, we design and manufacture. Mm. The inspiration, a lot of the inspiration still comes from Japanese barware, though.
So do you design those?
Yeah, I mean, our team does at Cocktail Kingdom. We have people that design everything. We often work with celebrity bartenders, people from our world like Dave Wondrich, the author of Imbibe and a great cocktail historian, has helped us with a design of a barware that's based on antiques. One interesting thing about Japanese barware is some things could be a bit of a misnomer. I mean, I can blame myself for the Japanese style jigger that we call it now, which is what I named it a dozen or more years ago. Turns out to be an American patent that was then made in Japan. We stopped making it in the United States. And so now what we call what's commonly known as the Japanese style jigger, which is a measuring device that's two-sided, often 1 ounce on one side and 2 ounces on the other, is actually a U.S. patent from the late 1800s.
Interesting. That's like a Kumamoto oyster. Kumamoto oyster died, extinct in Japan, and then came back and then
they brought it, yeah.
We started here again. So what is the key, though? Is this the precision, or what's the... What makes a difference?
It's the quality. I mean, and the aesthetic being matched with something that's manufactured to be used on a commercial bar on a busy Saturday night. So the coil of the spoon is smoother, so it won't hurt your finger when you're stirring lots and lots of drinks over the course of the night. And then there are some types of barware that are more common in Japan than they're in the U.S., again, the cobbler shaker, which is a three-piece shaker with a strainer built in. Again, a U.S. patent, but it's much more common to see Japanese bartenders using the cobbler shaker. American cocktail bartenders will be using two tins, tin on tin. Usually an 18-ounce and a 20-ounce tin that then fit together. I don't know if in Masa in Japan, did you start with cobbler shakers?
Yes.
Yeah, that'd be much more common.
I really wonder, though, I think Japanese people tend to have crazy mindset to just pursue everything in tools. I think that's the craftsmanship buried since the beginning of the history of Japan. Like, you know, the Japanese cooking knives, I think that's based on samurai sword. Mm-hmm. And samurai sword is banned, now switched to culinary knives, that kind of thing. So there is a foundational aspect of it.
Yeah, and single purpose things. In other words, a spoon that is made for stirring cocktails, a strainer that is made for straining cocktails, not finding something that is... Americans often, I mean, I'm generalizing, but like to find something that's good for everything. And I find when I started going to Japan a lot, I would find more specialized tools that were for a very specific purpose and in a lot of ways better.
Right. Yeah, it's like a wasabi grater. That's the samurai, the shark skin.
Shark skin, yeah.
Right. But so, for instance, before that, was the German tools as good as Japanese? Because they are more...
Currently, a lot of barware is made all over the world. So a lot of the Japanese barware isn't made in Japan. A lot of the German barware isn't made in Germany, but the Germans continued to make a style of Hawthorne strainer, which is the strainer that has a coil built into it. So you might use after shaking a drink, and you want to make sure to get more bits and pieces strained out. So there was some German strainers, but again, now, I mean, Cocktail Kingdom, we manufacture our products all over the world at this point. But yeah, there's a German cocktail culture as well, but it's definitely not as amazing as the Japanese cocktail culture. Like Japanese cocktail culture in the 1880s, 1890s, people left Japan to travel around the world to bring things back, and that was the golden age of the American cocktail, as I mentioned earlier. So in Japan, they managed to capture barware as well as cocktails at their height, when everything was being made the best, being made in a very purposeful way, and they kept doing that. So when I started looking into both cocktail culture and barware history, I had to go to Japan because we had prohibition in this country. They never did, so nothing stopped people in Japan from continuing to make great cocktails and great barware.
Right, and I think Japanese mind is to preserve something already existed and try to make it better rather than try to change or anything, so that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, James was mentioning that with, noticing that with cocktail bars, the classic cocktail bars in Japan.
How do you describe it?
In Japan?
Yeah.
Very traditional, fantastic cocktails that they're making, but again, a lot of the bars are very similar in the traditional sense of you walk in, you sit down, you're very quiet, you order your drink, You wait a little while for the drink, but it comes out fantastic.
And they are classic cocktail.
And they're classic cocktail, right? Yeah, exactly.
I wonder, so is it maybe the same mindset as making sushi? Because you cannot break the rule. And for cocktails, if you go beyond the classic recipes, you may need...
I think recipe cocktails, I think it's more about concept. You know, so like Manhattan is Manhattan, but martini is martini. But there's room to kind of adjust to just for you, Akiko-san. Like, for example, like, you know, you have your preference in balance of the drink. So, or fashion or anything that the classic cocktail. To me, it's about the drink or recipe, those things as a concept. Yes, you have to have certain ingredients, but the ratio changes. It depends on how client likes. And
interesting. So yeah, maybe more customized version of
there class. Can be. Kaza Ueda, who is the owner of Tender Bar in Ginza, and also Cocktail Kingdom publishes his book in English language. It's originally written in Japanese, has said that there's every classic cocktail has four recipes. The original recipe, the currently accepted recipe, the bartender's favorite version of the recipe, and the customer's favorite version of the recipe.
Interesting. So. Right. That reminds me of the concept of omotenashi, like hospitality. So I think that's why, you know, as it was mentioned, it's not eight seats or only limited in this country, but they really pay 100% attention to you as a customer, although you may have to wait a little bit. But
the customer service is fantastic. And even while you are waiting, you're just watching them make the cocktails within itself as a show. It's very fun to watch.
Yeah, that you're paying for admission to a show to watch the craft of the bartender. At Katana Kitten, certainly watching Masa behind the bar, he has the fluidity of motion, but also a little bit of a little bit of whimsical nature as well.
Right, interesting. So that's the part that I don't think we really know about Japanese mysterious cocktail culture. I mean, a hush-hush bar, people say it, but there's a warm, flexible hospitality side in it, and the Katana Kitten has it. So that's exciting. Who buy those bottles? Like, fine, all over the country, you get an order from...
All over the world. Yeah, we have cocktailkingdom.jp. We actually sell back to Japan a lot now.
Wow.
But yeah, all over the world, Cocktail Kingdom is, we consider ourselves professional barware for professional bartenders. But as we, with knives, of course, home users want the knives that the professional chefs are using. And we definitely have a lot of home users buying Cocktail Kingdom barware on our website. But the website's in multiple languages. It's in French and German and Spanish and and Japanese, as I mentioned. So the people buying it are definitely professional bartenders. That is the bulk of our business, but certainly home users as well.
Oh, home users too. Wow. Yeah. Great. Yeah, I think nowadays cocktail world is globalized too. So at least Japan is, taking a part of it. That's nice.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so what is your plan?
Going for it?
Plan?
Well, you can say anything. Plan for next vacation to where are you going to open another Katana Kitten number two? Or
I think right now we're focusing on this one and making it stronger and every day going in there and making it better and better. And that's kind of the focus from there. And then we'll move from there and see kind of what happens. But right now, all the focus is on Katana Kitten in West Village.
Yeah, we're still pretty new. We're excited, just having made the transition from summer into fall. This past weekend was quite busy in a good way, from under control and busy, not hectic and busy. So I think really just planning on getting, settling into fall and getting ready for the what in our cocktail world is a very busy season.
Right. I really learned today that Katana Kitten is a little, you know, precious window to the Japanese cocktail culture, but it's approachable. So hopefully you can expand or something. Maybe you can open one in Japan.
That'd be fun.
Right.
That'd be very cool.
Okay, so for listeners, where can we find more information about Katana Kitten and on Cocktail Kingdom?
katanakitten.com. Both websites are pretty straightforward, so katanakitten.com, or just come by Hudson Street and say hi, and then also it's cocktailkingdom.com. Mm. Cool. Definitely the best way to get more information.
Okay, great. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, okay, so listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japanese@heritagevideonetwork.org. And Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays, always available at heritagevideonetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and write a review. We appreciate your feedback. And our engineer today is Matt Pattinson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.